Welcome to Free for All Fridays on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Good afternoon. I'm Dave Kaufman in for Amanda Galbraith on this Friday, the 24th of September, and it is a Free for All Friday. We have a lot to get to, and of course, there's breaking news, which we are going to keep our eyes peeled on and bring you any developments as we have them. Let's bring in our panelists today. He's CTV's political analyst, the former leader of the New Democrats, Tom Mulcair. Hello, Tom.
Hello there. How you doing, Dave?
I'm well. Good to hear your voice, my friend. And let's bring in Zane Velji, a political campaign strategist, partner at North Weather. He formerly worked on the Nenshi and Notley campaigns and has done a great job filling in for Evan all summer long. Zane, pleased to meet you, man.
Dave, what's going on?
Oh, so much is going on. And of course, we're going to start with the breaking news, which with huge implications for Canada. Reuters reporting that sources are saying that Huawei chief financial officer Meng Wanzhou is expected to appear in a U.S. court right now via satellite link to resolve charges against her. This has obviously been so well documented in Canadian news for a long time. She was arrested in British Columbia on request from the U.S. Department of Justice. Of course, we know that the case of the two Michaels, who are now nearing 1,100 days in Chinese prisons, they were arrested in China in what many believe to be an act of retaliation. Tom, I want to get your thoughts on this, what it means, and I think most importantly, what Canadians want to know is whether this is the first step towards bringing the two Michaels home.
I think that the two are so obviously connected that you're completely right to say it that way. It is the first step towards getting the two Michaels home. The Chinese will probably wait a little bit, have an appeal process, decide that it's their rule of law that decided, and it has nothing to do with Meng Wanzhou. This has been a mistake from the beginning. Canada acted in flagrant contradiction of our own extradition act, because it says that if the request is political, you deny it and the person is let go. Here, we held on to her, even though Donald Trump had clearly and explicitly said that he would hold on to her, but he would let her go if he got the trade deal he wanted. It couldn't have been more clear that it was political. But what was needed at this stage is a face saver. This is a face saver for everybody, because Joe Biden couldn't appear to be weak with China. Of course, Trudeau has already messed up our relationship with China, something fierce. And this is the best solution. She gets to go home. The Americans get to pretend that it's in accordance with their system. The guilty plea, if that's indeed the deal that's being made, will, of course, have zero meaning. They'll pay a fine and everybody moves on. But there will still be a lot of bruises left over once this thing is done.
Zane, I look at the date. It's the 24th of September. And we'll get to it in just a second. We had a federal election on Monday, on the 20th of September. Do you think that there's a timing issue here? The Chinese, obviously no fans of Justin Trudeau. Do you think that there's something to be said about why this is happening now and not maybe a week ago and giving Justin Trudeau a bump before the election?
Yeah, no, I think you've nailed it exactly right. Justin Trudeau has struggled on the international relations file, to put it lightly, to Tom's point. I mean, this is China's one of the issues. India was another one. I mean, his general sort of Canada is back mantra has soured a lot of folks domestically, but has actually made life for him extremely tough in diplomatic situations across the world. So, you know, if you're China, you know, you probably don't want to give Trudeau the bump leading up to and during the election. And you do it after simply to get it over with. You probably even, you know, think about considerations like you do it on a Friday, on a day where most news is about taking out the trash. I know this news will resonate and reverberate over the weekend, but there is strategy applied here, if I can say it that way. And now that you know he's going to be prime minister, might as well get it done and over with in this mushy middle period rather than give him a win later on in his term in some way. But to Tom's point, you know, this may not be the first step. This might be the only step that was even available with the trade-offs here, right? For the longest time, you know, those that have been supporters of the prime minister have said these two things are not linked. I think we're going to find out very quickly, perhaps even in weeks, that these two things are certainly linked with Meng Wanzhou, you know, going and with the two Michaels coming.
So I don't want to get ahead of ourselves here, and let's play this out and assume that the two Michaels do come home from this, Tom. Is that the end of the friction between Canada and China? Are we now happily going to the Olympics? So all of the conversations, all of the rhetoric that, that Aaron O'Toole raised during the election, does that all go away?
I may be a committee of one on with this point of view, but I don't think we should be going to the Olympics because of what's happening to the Uyghur Muslim minority in China. And it's been properly described at the UN level as a genocide in terms of the UN definition of genocide, you know, trying to destroy a culture or a religious group the way that the Chinese are going after the Uyghurs right now. So I think that this would be the equivalent of not having the 36 Olympics in Berlin, but having the 1940 Olympics in Munich. I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me. We're either going to take a stand on human rights or we're not. But we have watched our own position and credibility on human rights become such a tatters. We talk a good game, but we're just not there. But I think it might be hard for us to back away, especially if all of our allies are going to be going to those Olympics in China.
Zane, I'll let you weigh in on that as well. I did not expect that answer from Tom.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. And he might find a committee of another person to join the club. You know, the I say this as being a Muslim, but it doesn't take a Muslim to recognize what's very clearly happening in China with this genocide. So to answer your political question there, Dave, I mean, yes, it helps. I don't think it ends it, though, right? What aids Justin Trudeau in this situation is getting the two Michaels back. So the biggest, highest ticket sort of item that the public is aware of regarding China is perhaps now off the table, knock on wood, should this happen. You also have an aid in having a new U.S. government. This is not the Trump government that continues to, you know, wedge Canada in situations, you know, whether, you know, politically or otherwise in our relationship with China. Now, you probably have a better ally in Joe Biden in that regard that, for example, would not have put Canada in the situation with the Meng Wanzhou crisis that we faced as well. But as it relates to Justin Trudeau's profile internationally, I don't think this necessarily helps. China has quite literally been campaigning domestically using Justin Trudeau as a weak leader narrative to win points in provinces and domestically in China. Justin Trudeau, for them, is a political pinata, and he will continue to be that regardless of the two Michaels situation. And so as it relates to the actual relationship between Canada and China, and more specifically between Justin Trudeau and China, expect them to keep hammering because there's still domestic benefit for the Chinese government to do so.
I can't believe that a country of 35 million matters that much to the Chinese. Let's spend a couple of minutes. Yeah, go ahead, Zane.
Well, here's the thing, though, right? We're small, but anytime you find vulnerabilities, you're going to use them. And they have been. If you look at what, you know, the not just the trips of Justin Trudeau in China have been, but the outpouring of trying to position Canada in a certain way of weak leadership, especially in their times when they were aligning themselves to Trump, it was a real contrast in terms of style of leadership. And I think that will keep continuing.
Tom, do you think that this matters? Do Canadians care what the Chinese think of Justin Trudeau?
Well, I mean, it has been a real mess. His first trip to China, by the way, was a resounding success, and the Chinese rolled out the red carpet, and they were very good to him. I do remember Gerald Butts essentially taking over the meeting and running it as if he was prime minister, but I digress. With regard to his second meeting, you can recall that Canadian journalists were roughed up by security forces there, pushed around, and the pushback was physical and imagery because they were pushing back against Mr. Trudeau's even vaguest attempts to discuss human rights issues with regard to China. They'll always push back on that. They have no human rights issues. They'll always tell you straight up, any country that has over a billion people that can feed, clothe, house, give medical care, and, you know, schooling to everybody in that country is allowed to lecture us. The rest of you guys can go home. And so they'll point to severe and serious inequalities in our society and say, we have no lessons to receive from you on human rights. That's always been their take on this. My very first meeting as leader of the opposition with the Chinese ambassador, very cordial meeting, very businesslike, set agenda. And at one point he basically said, don't you ever talk about human rights in China. Of course, didn't stop me, but it's their point of view. You know, like, you will never be our friend if you lecture us on human rights.
Yeah, and I would imagine that our relationship is not close enough. I mean, Canada could barely lecture the United States on some of its Trumpian policies that we found morally objectionable. So how on earth could we say it to an avowed enemy without knowing that it's going to cause us some trouble? When we come back on Free for All Friday, was the election worth it? And what do we do with the PPC? You're listening to the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
The Free for All Friday Roundtable continues on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Welcome back to the program. I'm Dave Kaufman, along with Zane Velji and Tom Mulcair. This is Free for All Friday. And I would imagine that a lot of us are still recovering from Monday night, which bled into Tuesday morning. And in fact, even today, there was a mail-in procedure that finished and a seat flipped to the Conservatives. Unbelievable to think that they are still trickling in the results from the 44th federal election. Let's hear from now Prime Minister Justin Trudeau.
If you did not vote for us, I want you to know that we will stand up for you and work for you every single day.
And guess what? Aaron O'Toole has no plans of going anywhere, and he wants to keep working for Canadians too.
My family and I are resolutely committed to continuing this journey for Canada.
Well, good to know that he is. I don't know if all of the Conservatives are on the same journey right now. Tom Mulcair, we know our history in Canadian politics, and oftentimes a new leader of a party gets one kick at the can, and if it doesn't work, they're out. Who?
I know a little something about that. Yeah,
yeah. You know, I tried to do this as delicately as possible, but you have faced this head on. And I will ask you: Do you think it's fair? Do you think it's fair to only have one shot at it?
That's not the question. The question is the party going to be able to move forward if they do make that change? And I think that after Andrew Scheer's debacle, there was nothing that could be done that would have changed the result, because Andrew had these profoundly held personal beliefs around a woman's right to choose, around, you know, gay rights, these LGBTQ rights. I mean, these were rights that he struggled with, and everybody picked it up during the campaign, and it wouldn't have mattered. You can't be in this century and still hold to those views, and you're allowed to have those views, but you can't hold to those views and expect that the average Canadian will say, yeah, that's fine. You know, I'm going to go with him. There were a number of people who voted for Scheer. In fact, he got more votes than Trudeau, as did O'Toole. But the big difference is everybody keeps pointing to the fact that the extreme right of the Conservatives have gone off and followed Maxime Bernier. But I think that that's something in favor of O'Toole. He gets to say, look, yes, we've lost a certain part of that vote, but mainstream Canadians, we didn't win anything in Toronto, but we will next time. He's introduced himself as a middle-of-the-road guy with values that are conservative on many things, but also in touch with the mainstream of Canada. So I think that a lot of people are underestimating Aaron O'Toole. The guy was not supposed to beat Peter McKay. He beat him. He was not supposed to have the slightest chance in holding back Trudeau from his majority. He held Trudeau back from his majority, and he did quite well and got more votes than him. So I think, I actually know, because I know one senior minister from the Harper era and one very senior communications and organizational type from the Harper era who would love to bring in Pierre Poilievre because he's ideologically pure. But he's also the type of person who's very divisive. He's very off-putting, and he would never have the slightest chance of going anywhere near where O'Toole or even Scheer went in their election. So I think that the Conservatives are just going to have to make their minds up. Do they have this nostalgic longing for the Harper era, or are they going to try to actually win an election?
Zane, I'm going to flip it. I'm going to ask you to give a different answer to a different question than the one that okay. Tom had there. Do you think the Jagmeet Singh gets a third kick at the can, and do you think that Justin Trudeau gets a fourth?
So I think Jagmeet Singh, let's start here with the ND question, gets another kick at the can. Yes, for a couple of reasons. Number one, he's currently in the position to be the power broker. He has the kingmaker power broker position. And that's the only reason why on election night 2019 and in redux fashion on election night 2021, he celebrated like he did and could get away with it. He came in fourth, but has this power broker position. If he had not, and this was a majority government, I think we'd have a very different answer. So I think the saving grace for Jagmeet Singh is the position he holds in our next parliament. As it relates to Justin Trudeau, I think the jury's out on this one. You know, there's one school of thought that says that a minority was not a majority. This is an embarrassment. This is a failure. He needs to move on a couple years into this minority, do it gracefully, take that long walk in the snow, so to speak, and we figure out our next leader. The other school of thought is that Justin Trudeau has an opportunity in this new minority parliament that is pushing him left to get through some of those legacy projects. And if he does, and he does them well and executes rather than symbolism, which has been his strength, symbolism, and now focuses head down on execution, that he might write his ticket to another government and another chance to get reelected should he want it. So I think the jury's still out on Trudeau, but I'm on a solid yes that Jagmeet Singh gets to keep going, despite the fact that there are some odd activists here and there saying that this was a $25 million ad buy for Jagmeet Singh. He didn't pull the vote he needed to, but I think there's enough promise electorally for him. He's liked enough, but most specifically above all of that, he holds a position in the upcoming parliament that I think NDs will be quite happy about and will not replace him because of that.
Tom, I was walking in downtown Montreal last night, and there were electronic billboards on St. Catherine Street advertising the PPC. So they're a day late or a week late and a dollar short, but 5% of Canadians thought that this was the best place to park their vote. Have we underestimated populism in Canada, and what do we do now?
No, we haven't underestimated it. But I do think that the 5% is the definite high watermark. Maxime Bernier is not going to be attracting people. He was able to bring into his tent, such as it was, all of the anti-vaxxers and all of the none of the above crowd, you know, the up yours crowd, people saying, I hate you all, and I'm going to go and vote for this guy because he says stuff that I want to hear. When Bernier started doxing journalists and getting his Looney Tunes wing to start going after journalists individually, not only was he bounced from Twitter, but he lost whatever little eensy weensy credibility he ever had. I mean, the guy has just marginalized himself. He's shown himself to be a flake, and, you know, let him continue. It's a free and democratic society. He's got his political party. Let him keep slogging away, but nobody's going to be following him, and he won't be on the stage for the debates in the next campaign either, because he won't get 4% in the polls as we head into the next one. The 5% was a fluke, and it's never going to go higher.
Tom, the thing that scares me about everything you said just now is that these were the same dismissals that were said about the populist leader in the United States 5 years ago. So, Zane, I'll ask you, is the difference between Maxime Bernier and Donald Trump my point is that one had the weight of the Republican Party under him, and one has a fringe party with 5%. And Tom, you're more than welcome to jump back in. I want to hear from both of you. We've got about 3 minutes left. Tom, you first.
Well, I was just going to say that the populist leader in the United States, as you just pointed out, was representing a mainstream party. And second of all, he didn't get 5%. He got 50%. You know,
right.
I mean, are pretty darn close to it. So I don't think that the two are comparable.
Zane?
I agree. They're not comparable. I think the PPC is going to be a great grift for Maxime Bernier. Let him earn a salary. Let him keep these people angry. I am perhaps not aligned with Tom in the sense that I think he can keep volleying anger, keep volleying division. I hate to say that my province is a leading indicator of that. I sit here in Alberta, but in many ways, it could be a leading indicator of that the divisions within the conservative fray continue. And the best thing that will happen to Maxime Bernier is if the conservatives reclaim Erin O'Toole as their leader and they give him the green light to pick that PC lane. I think it allows Maxime Bernier to have the through line of anger while still building and chipping away at the right flank of the Conservative Party in the off cycle between now and whenever the next election is. And so I think a lot of it is contingent on some moves of the Conservatives, but I feel like there is some anger and palpableness that might rescind a bit, but I feel he'll be able to keep it alive, at least to form a nice little healthy grift for him to keep that anger at peak measure for supporting a fundraising of a quote-unquote political party.
Looking forward to seeing the Mad Max Bears up for sale. So if... would this mean then, if we put on our revisionist history caps, gentlemen, that Maxime Bernier came within a hair of being the leader of the Conservative Party when Andrew Scheer defeated him on the final ballot?
Yeah.
My theory, would it hold a bit more weight if Bernier had won the Conservative leadership and had the weight of that party behind him?
I don't know.
Well,
if Bernier,
he would have still been Maxime Bernier.
Exactly. Keep going, Tom.
Guys, we got to leave it there. When we come back, are the vaccine passports letting us get back to normal? We'll find out. This is the iHeart Talk Radio Network.
Free for All Friday Roundtable continues on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Welcome back. I'm Dave Kaufman in for Amanda, along with Zane Belge and Tom Mulcair. It's a pandemic of the unvaccinated, they say. Vaccine passports will give us the freedom to live our lives. You know, you turn on the television and you see 70,000 people at a football game last night, or you get an ad on Twitter for the Rolling Stones heading off on tour. And yeah, we'll be talking more about the Stones in about 10 minutes time. If somebody knows Jerry Agar, let them know we'll be talking about the Rolling Stones. 2 weeks in a row, the Stones come up on Free for All Friday. A coincidence? I think not. So is life finally getting back to normal? Are you planning on, as they boost seating at Scotiabank Center and the Rogers Center, will you be going to cheer on the Jays as they try to make the playoffs? Are you comfortable going on and living life like it was in February of 2020? Tom, I'll start with you. What do you think? Is this purely a pandemic of the unvaccinated now?
Well, if you look at the numbers that are being put up by the various provinces, Alberta just confirmed the same thing that Quebec said 2 days ago, that 100% of the people in ICU are unvaccinated. So I don't think that title is wrong. With regard to what sporting event I'd feel comfortable in, I'd be a lot more comfortable for some reason. Maybe somebody will tell me that scientifically I'm wrong, but I'd feel more comfortable at a Blue Jays game, just given the openness and the size and the scope and the space, than at, let's say, you know, with 22,000 people at a hockey game. But hey, that's just me.
No, I'm with you on that. But the thing is, we see people, and it's as if there are two schools of thought on this. Like I said before, I spent a couple of hours downtown Montreal yesterday, a beautiful, almost like a perfect summer night, even though it's the end of September, and the restaurants
were packed. It was 30 degrees.
And the bars were
about
full. Right. Exactly. Well, you know what? Right. We can look into why that's a problem, or we can enjoy it in the moment. And last night I was enjoying it in the moment, and I was sitting out on Crescent Street having my dinner, waiting for my iPhone to be ready at the Apple Store, which still isn't ready. So if anybody's trying to call me, good luck. I was struck by the fact that to some people, there is no pandemic. Life continues unabated. And for others who are vaccinated, yet continuing to be careful, it's just this very difficult contrast. It's something I think of when I turn on the TV and I see a full NFL stadium. Zane, it's something I thought of in the last 36 days watching politicians glad-handing and getting close to people and trying to get your vote.
You know, my province here in Alberta has given us a preview of what happens when a large portion of your population enters into a collective hallucination that the pandemic is over. We had our open for summer plan, July 1st, Calgary Stampede, Jason Kenney saying we will never, ever go back into lockdown. We're in endemic stage. And here we are, right? Refusing at that point, by the way, on July 1st, to implement or even hint at, in fact, fundraising off of the opposition of vaccine passports, which brings us to today, where we have, as Dwayne Brad, a political scientist in Alberta, commented on television last night, we are having a Humboldt bus crash worth of casualties every single day in Alberta. And our ICUs are filled to the brim. We have an unbelievable, harrowing situation happening here. And even for folks that want to live their lives now, I think they're snapping back into focus that their behavior, even with our vaccine exemption, restriction exemption program here in Alberta, which is pretty much a fancy word of vaccine passports, but making the businesses hold the onus to implement them should they choose to or not. People are in a situation in my province where going out, enjoying yourself, attending a sporting event is a political act. It's almost an act of modeling a certain type of behavior, knowing that there are so many unvaccinated still out there, knowing that we are in the throes, in our case, the peak of our public health crisis. So, you know, while I would feel comfortable going out, enjoying the summer and kind of did, we are in a position here in Alberta where we've retreated, retrenched, and it's almost now become a political act, whether you show up to a hockey game for the Flames or the Oilers. And I hear many friends talking about that as the two hockey teams have announced their capacities restricted or lack thereof in the coming days. So it's a fascinating dynamic, but an unbelievably sad human cost that we're experiencing here in my home province.
Tom, as I listen to Zane and feel nothing but sadness, I'm also reminded of what Quebecers went through in the first wave, especially anybody who had a relative in a senior's home.
We have the worst record of deaths per population still to this day in Canada, because we never applied the rule that BC and Ontario applied of saying to health workers, you can't go from one center or one hospital, one old folks' homes to another. And it was a lesson learned in Italy early on. It was passed along. Quebec never got it done. And we're still paying a price today, even though our numbers of COVID-19 are way down, because we've got it. We do have in Quebec a very high vaccination rate, maybe because everybody, you know, had the bejesus scared out of them with what happened. We're watching our own system start to collapse because the nurses are just leaving in droves. They can't take it anymore. They're burnt out. They're exhausted. And they've always been the backbone of the healthcare system. So we're far from being out of the woods here in Quebec either.
Oh, well, nobody's out of the woods. And as Zane mentioned, looking at what Jason Kenney did, and last week on this show, I compared it to George W. Bush standing on the aircraft carrier with the mission accomplished behind him. The second that you are anything other than humble in the face of COVID-19, it attacks and it multiplies and it just makes life altogether miserable for everybody involved. I wonder, and I'd love to hear both of your thoughts on this, if one of the biggest problems that we have as a country right now is that we are not on the same page at the same time, which makes fighting this disease, especially while interprovincial travel continues, even more difficult. Zane.
Absolutely. I mean, it is a problem that has existed prior to the pandemic. It's been catalyzed because of the pandemic. And I'll argue, as I have on other shows on this network, that our political leaders, at least a certain portion of them during this federal election, drove that wedge even deeper. So the fact that we are not on the same page is no surprise to anyone, especially when you have a cohort of people that are finding their tribe of, you know, perhaps fueled by misinformation and disinformation about vaccines to begin with, about lockdowns to begin with, about masks to begin with. And then, you know, finding a social justification for that behavior by having one another form that tribe in the real world and online. And that is now bubbling up to pay a massive, massive cost vis-a-vis human lives all across this country.
Tom?
Well, I mean, the provinces have taken very, very different approaches. Some of the Atlantic provinces were the toughest early on. For example, banning people. You were allowed to drive through, but you couldn't stop, couldn't go and use a washroom at a Tim's, but you could drive through, or some of them simply blocking their borders. It was chaotic. It was catch-catch-can. It was everyone for themselves. And the feds could have used the existing emergency legislation to declare an emergency across Canada. They chose not to do that. The feds weren't even a clearinghouse for the practices. We just talked about one example of best practice that was put into place in British Columbia and in Ontario. When the dust settles on this thing, we'll have a lot of lessons to learn, because this is probably not the last time the country will go through something where we should have a way of approaching things that is more centralized. But given the fact that healthcare is 100% provincial jurisdiction, the feds are responsible for a certain number of things, but never in the healthcare delivery, unless you're in a penitentiary, on a First Nations reserve, or in the armed forces. But across Canada, it's the provinces. But there, you know, there was no guidance, there was no coordination, there was no communication amongst them that was worthwhile. And you wind up with completely different results. Quebec in the first wave, tragic mistakes across the board, started learning the lessons as we moved along. Alberta got through the first wave a heck of a lot better. And then in the fourth wave is the only province that's watched its health system completely submerged. Now they're thinking of using the armed forces to fly people out to places like Ontario to get care. And we keep forgetting about the fact that as every single bed in a hospital fills up with COVID-19 patients and every bed in ICU is taken up with them, there are a lot of people who have serious diseases and conditions that would have required surgeries or other attention in our hospitals. And those people, you know, who would have loved nothing more than to see everybody around them with the vaccine, having been vaccinated. Instead, they're being punished for something that is the fault of the people who are just too obtuse to bother to get themselves vaccinated.
Yeah, I saw messages on social media of doctors telling people, don't do anything in Alberta. Don't do anything this weekend that could put you in a hospital. Don't go rock climbing. Don't ride a motorcycle. Maybe if you're going to play hockey, put your helmet on. There are just, you don't want to crowd up the hospital right now. Things
you don't want
so
to go
dire.
To a hospital. Okay.
You don't want to go to a hospital. That's right. You're listening to the iHeartRadio Talk Network. When we come back, why we all love Ted Lasso so much.
Free for All Friday Roundtable continues on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Dave Kaufman in for Amanda on Free for All Fridays, talking over one of the greatest rock intros of all time. It feels like a cardinal sin. I can't remember which one I talked over last week, Nick, but in Master Control in Toronto, but I felt the same level of guilt that I feel right now.
You're forgiven for
Monday,
this week.
Thank you. On Monday, the Rolling Stones played their first show without drummer Charlie Watts. Their tour launches in earnest on Sunday, but last Monday they played a small show in Foxborough, Massachusetts, for a small crowd of invited guests brought there by Robert Kraft, the owner of the New England Patriots. And Mick Jagger dedicated the show to Charlie Watts.
It's a bit of a poignant night for us. This is our first tour in 59 years that we've done without our lovely Charlie Watts. And we all miss Charlie so much. So we'd like to dedicate this show to Charlie. So what a good...
And there you have it, dedicated to Charlie, as the entire tour will be. UK's newspaper The Sun reported that the Stones' tongue and lips logo will be adorned in black for the tour. And my first reaction when hearing the news that Charlie Watts had passed away, and I'm a huge Stones fan, I've seen them over 20 times. The first time I saw them was in 1989. I was a 9-year-old kid, and I've been hooked ever since. But I guess the question really that I'm wrestling with now is, I entertain the notion of flying south and seeing them one more time. Zane, we'll start with you. Are the Rolling Stones still the Rolling Stones without Charlie Watts?
It depends, because if they're going to go this round, this tour, and you know, really lean into the fact that this is a tribute, that this entire tour is a tribute, I think they can get away with it. But after that, it's really hard to tell, considering how important he was to the band. You know, we've seen other bands that have lost bassists, or in certain cases, early years, AC/DC losing a lead singer. But in this case, just because he was so germane to the entire operation, I don't know how they last beyond the tour. I could be dead wrong. I you know, the fandom, from what I'm hearing from you, Dave, seems to run extremely deep. So there might be an appetite to let it keep going. But I don't know how they do it in a way that isn't just a international tribute tour, and then that's it.
The founder of the Rolling Stones, Brian Jones, died in 1969 and was followed by a huge tribute concert in London's Hyde Park. The Stones continued on. They've gone through a bunch of guitarists since Jones. Ron Wood is the newest member of the band, and he's been there since the mid-1970s. Tom, does it hit the same if Charlie Watts isn't there?
No, but it depends who you replace him with, too. I mean, before Ron Woods, we had Mick Taylor, and I don't know if that many people remember him. It didn't help. But I think that as long as you've got Jagger and Richards, you've got the Rolling Stones. If one of those two is no longer there, then forget about it. You might as well be a bar band doing an imitation. But if you've got Jagger and Richards, I think you've got the Stones, legitimate.
Oh, that's interesting. See, I put Watts in that same category of triad, right? I think if you lose one of the three, which you have, unfortunately, I think that's where, to me, the line has been drawn.
Well, I'm so curious to see how many times do you see Watts' name there? I mean, the songs, the music, that was Jagger and Richards. You know, I'm not taking anything away from the late, great Charlie Watts, but I do think that you've got the two mainstays there now.
Well, and there are side issues to that, right? Can the Rolling Stones still charge thousands of dollars a ticket if it's a bunch of guys and Mick and Keith?
Well, they probably can if every tour people think it's the last one. You know, like, I feel like there's certain elements to it, in the sense that people will be like, I don't want to miss my last chance to see this iteration, or frankly the final version of the band. So conversations like this are perhaps massively helpful to the Stones as it relates to what happens next. I might as well take my chance. I might as well do it. I might as well fly south, or fly to Europe, or fly wherever I need to make this happen,
to recreate that feeling of joy.
Remember reading,
which quote, Tom?
interviewing Mick Jagger and him, you know, just opining. He says, "Well, I can't exactly see myself still singing Satisfaction when I turn 60. He's pushing 80.
And having seen them just a couple of short years ago, right before COVID, in Landover, Maryland at FedEx Field, where they closed with Satisfaction, I can tell you the crowd still goes crazy, and it's about recapturing that feeling of joy. And joy is where I want to finish today's show, where Zane Velge and I will next spend the next few minutes trying to convince Tom Mulcair that he needs to add a little bit more joy to his life. Now, this is not a commentary on anything that Tom does. In fact, I get along really well with Tom, and I can't believe I haven't shared a studio with him in over 2 years. But when we do hang out together, guys, honestly, for a leader of a former political party, he's a pretty cool dude. But Tom, you're missing Ted Lasso in your life.
I know.
I can tell you the amount of people that I have had this conversation with and then have come back to me a couple of months later and said, "Hey, you know what? You're right. That show makes everything a little bit better." And it's not the music. It's not the interpersonal relationships in it. And for me, it's not even that it's about being nice. Because you know what? Some people out here are actually nice. I know that there are a lot of people on this planet that are surprised that people treat each other with kindness and empathy like we see from the characters on that television show. Zane, I don't know what it is for you, but it hit me as I was watching the new episode last night why I love Ted Lasso as much as I do.
There's no COVID.
I'm getting to my point, and then I'll give you yours. There is no COVID on that show. It exists in a world where you can walk up to a stranger and have a conversation with them, where you can hug someone that's an acquaintance of yours, where you can ride the tube in London like many of us have done in the past. It is a breath of not just fresh air, but the air that we used to breathe and breathe on each other and spread around. And I think for me, that is one of the biggest things that makes me gravitate to this show every single Friday. It is a world that doesn't exist anymore. What are your thoughts?
Oh, that's very poetic. I don't know if I have as tight of a rationale other than to say three things. Number one, you mentioned empathy. I think that the show, time and place during a pandemic when we were all feeling burnt out and continue to in many ways. And you know, I've been more honest in acknowledging some of the mental health issues that as a society we've been facing. It was a great antidote and continues to be. Number two, where else can you find so many Apple products in a single 30-minute show to really try to sell you on upgrading from your iPhone 6 that maybe one of us on the show, myself, still rocks? And number three, I think it was an unbelievable masterclass in leadership and continues to be. And that to me is perhaps the least explored angle of it, which is as a coach of football in the UK, a sport he was not familiar with, to be able to take something on and show a masterclass of empathy and leadership at the same time, I think is really, really fascinating in that particular dynamic as well, Dave.
Well, along with anybody else who's listening who hasn't seen it yet, you've convinced me. I've got to give it a try. I just haven't had time.
I'm thrilled. Tom, is there a show that moves you the way that Zane and I are obviously moved by this show?
Well, the first few episodes of This Is Us I found really moving. I thought it was brilliantly well done. And then it became a spiral where they just kept trying to find new ways to go back and reintroduce and bring back the characters. And it sort of lost
nowhere close then. Nowhere close then, Tom. Tom, Zane, thank you both so much. I hope you have a wonderful weekend. And follow
you too, sir.
All the best. Take care, Dave.
In the spirit of Ted Lasso and my hero, Gord Downie, please, everybody, take care of each other.